something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. And I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
The following episode contains disturbing and graphic accounts of survivor experiences. It may not be suitable for younger audiences. Please listen with care.
From iHeartRadio, London Audio, and executive producer Paris Hilton, this is Trapped in Treatment. We're your hosts, Rebecca Mellinger
and Caroline Cole, one troubled teen industry survivor
and one investigator,
on a mission to expose the truths of an industry plagued by controversy and to make sure that no child has to experience the hell that is teen treatment.
In today's episode, we start at the beginning of every survivor's journey, the transport. Often taken in the middle of the night, crying out for parents instructed not to respond, this episode will be difficult to listen to and even harder to comprehend. We will talk to the sister of a survivor, a transporter, and a senator, all with their own perspectives of the transport journey.
Well, growing up, I had a really troubled time growing up with my family, to be honest. I normally was a really smart, funny, nice girl, but at home, it was fighting all the time, yelling, screaming.
Natalia Dominguez was just 12 years old when she first entered the foster care system. She was very soft-spoken when we talked with her. She told us how she moved around a lot, and she hated being home, where she felt attacked and cast out, so she looked to friends for support, finding a new crowd in every city she moved to, generally older and already experimenting with drugs.
I was really depressed up until age 11. That's when I started making friends and trying to not think about my family and what was going on at home. And I blossomed with friends, but when it came back to my family, you know, I was depressed all over again.
Eventually, she caught up with the wrong crowd. And one night, someone gave her a pill likely laced with fentanyl. When she woke up, she was in the hospital. For 2 weeks, she lay in a hospital room, crying and waiting for her parents to come. But they refused. Then one morning, a social worker came with some news.
A social worker came like at 12 in the morning, and she was like, well, you have to come with me. And I was like, no, my mom's gonna pick me up. She's just mad. And she ended up taking me, and I cried so much that night. My eyes have never been that swollen before.
Shuttled back and forth between group homes for a few years, she would eventually end up back with her father. Being home was better than being in the group home, so she did her best to make her father happy. until one early afternoon in 2006. Natali was sitting in her room, putting on makeup. She was 16 years old. She felt good, happy for the first time in a long time. Her dad was mad she hadn't gone to school that morning, but she was getting dressed, planning to head in to make him happy. She was almost ready to go when she heard a knock on her bedroom door.
My dad knocked on the door, and he said that someone was there to talk to me, and I said, "Hey, why did you call the cops? I'm here. I didn't leave." And it was a man and a woman. They said, "Do you want to do this the hard way or the easy way?" And they had my hands in their hands, my wrists in their hands, and I couldn't move. I couldn't go and say bye to my bird. Like, they had a firm grip on me at that point, and they did not let go. I was yelling, like, "Dad, who are these people? Where are they taking me? Why is nobody saying anything to me?"
Natalia was being transported, taken by strangers from her house to a school hundreds of miles away. Some might say that she needed to be sent away, that perhaps she was better off than being with her father or in foster care. But the uncomfortable truth? Natalia probably needed more attention, more support than ever before.
Trauma. A Greek word that literally means wound. The beginning of the treatment journey often starts with this word, a swift, confusing, and deep wound. A child's instincts are to trust its parents, its protectors, its guardians. Even when things are going wrong, they still instinctively want to trust. When this trust is broken enough times, it becomes impossible to believe that anyone truly cares for you. Often taking place in the middle of the night, but sometimes during the day, like my own transport, the most important element of the transport is surprise, when the child is least expecting it. They're often woken from deep sleep by two strangers, dressed in black, standing over them in their room. Others account being bombarded by these transporters while at school or even a friend's house. Their parents have been advised that this is the best course of action, the safest way to get their child to the treatment facility. It is fast, efficient, and an experience that every child can recall with heart-fluttering fear. Absolutely traumatic. The damage done by fast departures often extend far beyond the immediate individual. Siblings and family members are also traumatized, leaving fractures in trust and family cohesion for years to come. In 2006, Michael Krim was 16 years old, popular, charismatic, and always surrounded by friends from the neighborhood. His little sister Natalie was just 13 years old at the time, and she loved her big brother. Like any adoring younger sister, she recalls always wanting to hang out with him.
Since he was little, he was just always really funny. He was eccentric. He liked to dress differently. Michael has bright red hair, so he was like always the center of attention.
Natalie never heard her brother fighting with her parents. She doesn't remember him getting into trouble. He had never been sent away before, and in their close-knit family, something like that would have been obvious, or so she thought. So when he disappeared, literally overnight, it shattered Natalie's world.
So I was sent to my best friend's house for a sleepover, and that wasn't completely unusual to have a sleepover at her house on a school night, but it was kind of like a treat, like, oh, wow, I get to go stay at her house. And her mom took us to the movies and she took us to Johnny Rockets after. And then we went to school the next day. My mom was a little bit late to pick me up from school and I had left one of my books in my locker. So we had to go back and get it. And we got to the stoplight and I said, "When's Michael coming home? I haven't seen him, you know, in 2 days or something." And she's stopped and she said, "He's not coming home." So that was the first time I heard about it. She didn't They didn't really explain anything. We drove back to my house and my dad was home, and I kind of just ran upstairs to my room. And I remember my dad, you know, upset saying, "You told her," you know, and I just went in my room and I put music on, and that was the first I heard that he was gone.
Natalie was devastated. At just 13 years old, she couldn't quite comprehend what her mother had said. She slept in her brother's bed that night, waiting for him to come home. As time went on and months passed by, she eventually grasped that he was really gone. Grappling with the loss of Michael, she needed answers. How did he just seem to vanish? Finally, Natalie faced her parents and asked the question she could not bear to hold any longer. What really happened that night?
They were instructed, we had a dog at the time, so they were instructed to wait in the car outside with our dog, and Michael was sleeping in his bedroom, and two men came in and put him in handcuffs and basically, in my mind, kidnapped him in the middle of the night and walked him to a car, and then they put him on a plane, and he had to sit in the back of a plane in handcuffs, and he had no idea where he was going until he arrived in Utah. And I know, talking to my mom, that she said that when she walked back in the house, she went into his room and his bed was still warm, and that was just really upsetting for her.
As time went on and months passed by, she eventually grasped that he was really gone. Slowly, a rift began to form in the Krim household.
It created such a divide between me and my parents, especially though my dad, I blamed them a lot for him not being here.
While Natalie couldn't understand why her parents would send Michael away, they had their own reasons. It must be said that most parents who send their children for treatment often think it is the best and sometimes only solution.
And I think that they just didn't know how to handle, I don't want to use the word control, but they just didn't know how to keep Michael on track. And this was an opportunity that came to them, and they thought that this would be the best place. They were kind of I think it was just kind of a last resort for them.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, "Well, I had this career before, but it was a waste." And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Distressed, exhausted, and fearful for their kids, parents truly will do anything.
It can be easy to make the parents out as cruel, but there's often a much more complex reason that they consider sending their child away. At one point in every teen's life, there comes a moment where they begin to push away, to rebel. Parents often take this behavior personally. They feel like they're losing control of their child. However, this behavior is normal, and actually to be expected. An article written by bestselling author Dr. Lisa Damore, called The Seven Stages of Being a Teenage Girl, theorizes that especially for young women, there are seven key developmental moments that trigger behavior. Each stage is a necessary part of the transition from childhood to adulthood. Maybe if more parents understood this, they wouldn't be so quick to send their kids away.
2 years after being taken, Michael Krim finally returned home. But it wouldn't be until years later that he would open up and share the traumatic experiences he went through at Provo Canyon School with his family.
For other parents, sending their kids away can be a means of surrender.
So you think like 2.5 years, oh man, you must have been like a really bad kid. Like you must have been on drugs, like prostituting yourself.
Katie Mack is a survivor, one who attended Provo at the same time as Paris.
When I was young, so I'm from a big family, but when I was younger, it was a smaller family. And the youngest child, my little sister actually was diagnosed with cancer when I was 5 years old.
She watched as her parents succumbed to grief.
And over the next 5 years, we watched her like lose her fight to cancer, and she ended up passing away when she was 5 years old and I was 10 years old. And it really hit my parents hard. The best I can say, all grace to them, is they kind of mentally checked out for like a couple of years. Like my older brother and sister moved out to college, and I was kind of home alone a lot. And I think by the time my mom started checking back in when I was like 12 or 13, like by then the effects of like being kind of left alone while my sister was in treatment and being left alone and like neglected a little bit, not neglected like I was dirty with flies in the corner, just no one paying attention. I was a little bit like of a mouthy teenager. I definitely was like mouthy and rebellious and like talking back. That was really the big thing. And my parents, because they were so used to like my sister being sick and stuff, they saw everything as kind of a disease, something you had to treat, including my like teenage rebellion.
Katie would be sent to Provo for 2.5 years. Now an adult, she and her parents have found understanding and forgiveness. Like many parents who are unaware of the truths of the industry, they grew to regret their decision.
If you ask my parents now, they will apologize profusely and admit that this was kind of like the biggest mistake of their life, sending me away.
The parents of these survivors made decisions that would alter their children's futures forever, based on a judgment during one of the most transitional times in their child's lives. In this state of fear, parents are quick to lean into the arms of professionals, with the first call often being to a transport company. Angie Maddox, the founder of Next Step Youth, an at-risk youth transportation service, knows that call all too well. A previous juvenile probation officer, she's been working with at-risk youth for the past 27 years. While many conversations around transport services center on the wrong being done, We wanted to understand how and why parents and providers alike feel that this step is necessary.
We come in and we try to take the emotion out of it for the parents, because the parents are, it's so stressful and heart-wrenching. These parents are having to do this with their child to begin with. So trying to actually transport their child on their own is many times more difficult on not only the parent, but the child.
Angie describes her company as a Christian one, with an ethos of helping rather than hurting the kids. With over 15 years in child transport, she has observed transports from every background and influence.
They don't know our buttons. So they, you know, that's why it's safer. It's, you know, an unbiased person. It's not mom, dad, grandparent, you know, we're somebody else on the outside. And so there are so many times that it's definitely the best decision to hire someone who's trained in this field to take that child and get them there safely.
But many survivors detail this as the first and most defining trauma of their treatment experience. Regardless of well-meaning intentions from parents and transporters themselves, there's a clear lack of understanding of just how traumatic an experience this can be for a child.
Transport is often grouped together with the treatment, as they play a vital role at the beginning of a patient's journey. So it was surprising to learn that it is the parents who generally request the service. In fact, they are the only ones who can, due to the fact that a temporary release of custody is assigned to the hired transporter.
So we are hired most of the time by families, or at least legal guardians. Sometimes we are hired by a government entity. It could be a probation department, or it could be a mental health program that has guardianship over a child. But they basically hire us to take the child from, I always like to say, point A to point B. So if the parent hires us, most of the time we are going into their home and we are picking up the child in their home and we are transporting them either to a residential treatment center, a wilderness program, therapeutic boarding school. Sometimes it may be a hospital. Sometimes we're being hired to go pick them up at a hospital and take them to a long-term program.
Overwhelmed parents are then faced with the difficult decision: trusting someone to take their child away.
Almost, I'd say 99% of my agents have some form of law enforcement background or psychology or military. They're all degreed personnel. Their training consists of CPR, first aid. There's a program called Handle with Care that many of my agents are required to go through, and that teaches crisis intervention skills, de-escalation skills. We want all our agents to be able to go through that type of program or similar so that they know how to provide a safe transport for these children.
As good as all that sounds, many survivors detail this as the first and most defining trauma of their treatment experience. Not only are they being ripped from their beds, it's the timing of the transport that's the most difficult to comprehend. It's the industry standard to take children in the middle of the night. The element of surprise makes it much simpler for transport agents to control the situation, and all the more traumatic for the child.
A lot of kids will say, why didn't my parents tell me? Why didn't my parents tell me? Well, if your parents would have told you we were coming, would you be here? Well, no. And I'm like, okay. So that is why your parents didn't tell you. We just want to make the experience as least traumatic as possible for those kids without any injury. Think about it. If you walk into a house and the child's in a living room or a kitchen, then there's so many things that can happen. They can, you know, in a kitchen, they could grab all kinds of things to hurt themselves or us. There's a back door. They could run out a back door. There's too many things that they could get their hands on that, you know, could cause injury to them or the agents. So that's why waking them up in the morning, catching them off guard, and hopefully catch them in their bedroom contained is just a lot safer for everybody.
Safer for everybody? It sounds ideal, but is it accurate? Kids are often physically restrained during the journey. If they show any amount of noncompliance, this can look like anything from full body holds to handcuffs and zip ties. And while it may protect the agents, it doesn't protect the kids. There's no situation where being constrained and forcibly held is a passive or positive experience.
If they're fighting us, then my agents are trained to restrain kids safely. You know, not to hurt them, just to restrain them so they're not hurting themselves or us. And we talk to them and really work on the calming and de-escalating the situation to the best of our ability. When we do that, most of the time the kids do calm down because of how my agents are talking with them. But we tell the parents, we may have to restrain them if they're doing something that could cause harm to themselves or us. Otherwise, that's a very last resort because you'll have some kids just say, no, I'm not going. They're yelling and screaming and trying to hit us at the same time or spit at us or kick at us. So my agents do have to sometimes use those, you know, techniques.
These techniques have a documented history of causing harm, like the recent case of Cornelius Frederick, a 16-year-old boy enrolled at Lakeside Academy in Michigan. On April 29th of 2020, he threw a piece of sandwich at another student. 2 days later, he was dead, the result of improper restraint techniques used by staff at the facility.
Ma'am?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, tell me exactly what happened.
We had a student that was in a restraint, and now he's unresponsive.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The transport industry is another one of these things where it just blew my mind that it was real. I think most of us have seen it in movies or TV shows, and it just seems like this fantastical kind of a thing.
We were lucky enough to catch up with Senator Sarah Gelser Bluen, a state senator from Oregon who's been in office since 2013.
I can think of nothing more terrifying than being ripped from my bed where I think that I'm safe and being taken away by strangers that I think are kidnapping me while the parents that I trust to protect me are looking on. I mean, there's just so much that is wrong with it.
Appalled by what she learned about the treatment and transport industry after taking office, she now stands at the forefront of reforming several key aspects of this industry. Most recently, she tackled transports, fighting for regulation and oversight where it doesn't yet exist. Like most who become aware of the teen treatment and secure transport industries, Senator Gelser Bluen was shocked by the stories she was hearing. But something that really blew her away was the lack of regulation in the space.
You don't have to be licensed. You don't have to be certified. We don't have background check requirements. There's no restriction on the use of restraint and seclusion. If you look at the contracts parents sign, they give the transport providers permission to forcibly restrain children, including the use of mechanical restraints. That's how they get around child abuse allegations, because it's basically been directed by the parents who have, you know, more broad disciplinary authority. This is just horrific. It happens in public programs too. There was a youth in Oregon who was not violent, was not suicidal, but was put in ankle shackles and handcuffs to travel all the way from Portland, Oregon to Clarinda, Iowa. Wow. Through the airport, on the airplane. I mean, it's just unacceptable.
So unacceptable that in 2021, Senator Gelser Bluen introduced Senate Bill 710 to regulate the use of restraints and require licensure of transport companies. SB 710 was the first bill of its kind, requiring facilities within Oregon to report any and all restraint incidents publicly. In a move that would prove vital, she also included transport companies in the bill for any transports that begin or ended on Oregon roads. It requires that transporters be registered as child care agencies and expressly forbids the use of mechanical restraints of any sort.
So this legislation that I introduced this session, it's part of a broader bill that also will prohibit in Oregon the use of prone and supine restraint in all kids' residential programs and require some very specific training, a lot more transparency. We will know how many restraints and what types and seclusions are used in each facility quarterly, published on their website. You will be able to go to the website of Program Y and know how many kids they restrained that prior month and for how long they each were restrained. So as part of that bill, we took the transport companies and again became the first state in the country to do this. And we are requiring that they be licensed as child caring agencies, which means all of the restraint prohibitions apply to them. They are expressly prohibited from the use of mechanical restraints, from blindfolds, from handcuffs, strip searches, all of those things, they cannot do them.
This was positive news. At least one state in the nation making a ton of progress on safety within the transport industry. But that also means that there are 49 other states that currently have unlicensed companies transporting kids every day.
I think what is really needed is federal legislation, because what you're looking at is transporting kids across state lines. And I think that's, I hope that's something other states would look at as well. If we are removing children from their families because they aren't safe, we should be holding the people we're placing them with to a higher standard.
Out of sight, out of mind, or so the saying goes. But in the case of legal kidnapping, parents signing over guardianship to strangers who forcibly take their children in restraints, often from their beds, cannot be overlooked. Legislation like Senate Bill 710 is of vital importance to the regulation of this process and adds a needed layer of transparency, accountability, and hopefully safety for the youth being transported. We want to be clear. While we plan to challenge the overall need for this industry throughout this season, each step along the treatment journey is an important piece of the overall picture. Even with these added measures of safety in the transport process, once they arrive at their destination, innocent children are now prisoners of a program. One that claims to be a school but may prove to be one of the single most alienating and traumatic experiences of their lives. Once inside, it quickly becomes clear that Provo Canyon is not a school, not by a long shot.
You first get there, you have to experience girls screaming, locked up, peeing themselves, in the hallway sleeping. And you're like, where am I? Holy heck, this is not what I expected.
Next time on Trapped in Treatment.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.